Our final speaker is Dr. William Doherty. He's presently serving as president of the National Council on Family Relations. He's a professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota and director of their marriage and family therapy program. He's the author or co-author of 10 books and over 100 book chapters and scientific articles. His areas of expertise include responsible fathering, family-centered healthcare, which he spoke to you about in 1993, for those of you who were at that very first seminar. Marriage is an area of interest, and various aspects of family therapy. One of his books is called Soul Searching, Why Psychotherapy Must Promote Moral Responsibility, and he encourages therapists in that book to ask whether their therapy is individually focused or family focused, which is very similar to our goal here in the Family Impact Seminars, to look to promote a family focus. His latest book, which is coming out soon, is Act Like a Parent, Raising Your Kids with Confidence and Courage. And even if you don't read scientific journals, his name may sound familiar to some of you, because he's also published in Psychology Today and Better Homes and Gardens. So he's received several awards, the Rockefeller Foundation Bellugio Fellow Award, and he was recognized by the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy for contributions to the field. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of Minnesota. He's a licensed psychologist. He and his wife of 28 years have two children. And I'm just wondering, Bill, if you get published in Better Homes and Garden, does that mean you have a great house and a beautiful garden? Do you have to pass the screen?
No, I'll wait to the microphone.
Okay. His topic today is Family Life First, Activating a Grassroots Parents Movement. So what can parents do to improve parenting themselves? Thanks for coming, Bill.
If you publish in Better Homes and Gardens, your mother thinks you're important. And if you get on Oprah, then the extended family thinks you're important. And I've been on Oprah twice, and that didn't come up in the intro, but my family believes in me now, so it's great. I'm from Minnesota, as they say in Minnesota, a sibling state to Wisconsin. I moved to Minnesota 13 years ago, and I felt like I adopted Wisconsin as a sibling state. We have a lot in common. We care about families, the quality of life. We care about agriculture. We compete. We compete. And so you have a colorful governor, and we then got a colorful governor. I think this is one of the reasons why we did it. You had a great football team in the Green Bay Packers. And we had a great football team. You went down, we went down. We have to learn to separate more, I think. But I realized last night that you don't have a great history for University of Wisconsin-Madison sports. I'm sorry. And we do not have a great history. And it's because the Badgers and the Gophers, our mascot is a rodent. So we all have to do better. Well, what you had here so far are presentations of that represent 40 years of research on parenting and 20 plus years of research on treating antisocial youth. And what you have with me is about 10 months of no research, but an interesting grassroots movement. So you blame Karen for asking me to do it, because she called me to say, having this panel on parenting and, what's happening around, and I just told her this project that I'm involved in and this movement that's starting with no data yet, and she thought it might be useful to come and talk about it. So that's what I'm doing. There are two questions that started this movement. The questions are, and how many of you, and when I say how many of you, this came out of talks I gave to parents. How many of you think that children and families nowadays are overscheduled and too busy and have lost too much of their family time? A lot of you think that? How many of you think that? Okay. Most parents, most grandparents, most people who observe whether they have children or not think that. And then I ask people to tell me why. And I break them into small groups. I won't do that with you. And people have thought a lot about this. That has led to a second question of how many of you think that parents are also losing influence over what their children buy, what they wear, what they see on television and the internet? A little show of hands on that one. Okay, the theme is that parents are losing influence on a widespread scale across a variety of social class groups over the life and the development of their children. So those are the orienting questions, and I'm going to walk you through some ways that I think about this, and then a grassroots movement that's starting in suburban Minneapolis, and then I'll talk about a few policy implications. The first idea is I've coined the term family hyperactivity. Okay? And there's no medication for it yet that I'm aware of. The family hyperactivity, the overscheduled hyperactivity, in which we are trying to maximize kids' individual opportunities at the cost of family life, and also at the cost of whether they have any time to hang out. Now, I'll tell you a number of examples. There's a boy, a 10-year-old boy, who recently, in his list of top 10 birthday presents, the third one was time to hang out, because he is so overstructured. We have soccer, hockey, scouts, basketball, baseball, karate, piano, church, band, and that's just the beginning. A six-year-old in a suburban Minneapolis community just got her first daily planner. She is in seven carpools a week. Okay? That's why I talk about hyperactivity. There's especially an encroachment of sports activities onto family time. One mother said she feels terrorized by coaches. Okay? And I'm not wanting to villainize coaches, but we now have hockey, and you're big on hockey here too, right? We now have hockey practice on Thanksgiving morning. We now have the pastor of the local church announcing the first Sunday in September there will be no youth choir this year because the soccer games are on Sunday morning. And what's happening now, and I'm hearing this from, because we're talking to people who are involved in sports, again, there's no enemies here, that sports, all kids' sports are now becoming competitive sports, that we're losing the distinction between recreational sports and competitive sports. And once we get into the competitive aspect of it, family life becomes second or third down. So your kid joins the traveling soccer team, and then there's an orientation, this happened to some friends of mine, the orientation for the parents are told which 2 weeks in August they can take their family vacation. Okay? We're now defining commitment as commitment to that outside activity. There's a competition for the remaining time by churches and other faith communities, by music teachers, by scouts and others. In one suburban community outside Minneapolis, there was a summit meeting of the coaches and the clergy to divide up family time. Okay? There were no representatives of the parents present. And then we get battles between the churches and the sports. So one child was benched for the season because she missed a soccer game to go to her confirmation preparation weekend. And the coach sent home a nasty letter telling her she lacked commitment. Another child was ostracized by her group, by her youth group at church. She did not go to the Billy Graham crusade, which they'd been preparing for. Instead, she went to her brother's wedding. And she was ostracized by not only the kids, but the youth director was so angry he would not speak to her. And she also quit. So what's lost with this overscheduled hyperactivity is family time, family rituals, family participation, intergenerational participation in community, and time for children to entertain themselves. Then you add in the adult activities, the longer working hours, and then the recreational, the book clubs, the religious activities that kids are involved in, where we don't have intergenerational activities, and we have the family gravitational field not holding. We have people spinning further out from the family. This happening in widespread across the board in many of our communities. Now, I'm suggesting that this is not just an individual family issue, that it's a community issue, and that's what we're attempting to do, is to have community organization. Faced with your child wanting to participate in that second sport or already being committed to that second sport, the tremendous peer pressure to be there, to maximize that, it's very difficult for individual parents to withstand that. Some do, but for many it's very difficult. But one of the key parts of the ethic of this approach that I'm talking about, there are no villains, there are no scapegoats, we are all in this together. The coaches feel pressure by parents, The competitive parenting we're getting into now is a big part of this. So it's not, there are no particular villains. We have to approach this collaboratively. Well, what's this about at a deeper level, I believe, is what I call the consumer culture of childhood. I believe that the consumer culture has invaded the family in a substantial way. Children are now seen as consumers of parental services. Parents see themselves as providers of parental services and brokers of community services. Okay? What's lost is seeing children as citizens of families and communities, as young people with contributions and responsibilities to the common good. We have a generation of parents now who define responsible parenting by showing up at the kid's game. Eric Klebold, I forget his first name, one of the boys who was involved in the Columbine shooting, the day after this shooting, neighbors said he had good parents because they went to the soccer games. Okay, expecting children to participate in family activities and family rituals has ceased to be defined as the cornerstone of being a good parent. So parents are often seeing themselves as recreation directors on the cruise ship, as chauffeurs and as short order cooks. What I'm hearing from parents of young children now is that young children are not only declining to eat food that the parents serve because they don't like it, I mean, that's always been a factor. Now they're saying it's because they don't want it. I didn't want hamburgers tonight. I didn't want chicken. It's called the fast food culture invading the family, where everybody has their own particular menu. Okay? And actually, to ask everybody to have a family meal together is to ask for a degree of social conformity that is countercultural now. And kids confuse their wishes with their needs. So look at the frenzy about Beanie Babies and the hyper-competitiveness of parents about these sorts of things. It's hard to say no to enriching individual opportunities for children. It's hard to ask the cost. You make a series of decisions, and this is what parents in our group are now looking at. We make a series of decisions to maximize opportunities for each child, and we have then lost the ability to have family meals. We have lost the ability to have a family weekend outing. Grandparents are complaining about this because they don't have a way to get into the kids' schedules. So the six-year-old, maybe she can put grandma, grandpa on her daily planner, and then they may see them. We talk a lot about peer pressure among kids, but what I'm seeing is parental peer pressure. And that one mother told me recently, she thinks that in her community, the bragging rights now are not about how big is your house and how fancy is your car. It's how busy is your family. Okay? How busy is your family? And how many activities do you involve your kids in? In a rural town, college town, Northfield, Minnesota, a mother of a three-year-old counted 14 community activities for three-year-olds. And parents compete with each other about how many of those activities their kids are in. I know a mother of a four-year-old who seems to be athletic. I don't know exactly how you know a four-year-old's athletic. Who is being told by her family and friends she's already holding her kid back. Her kid is already behind. She should be in gymnastics. She should have been in at age three. We have people holding their kids back from first grade so their boys can be bigger and stronger as sophomores and juniors in high school and make the varsity and maybe get a scholarship. This is competitive parenting that's going on. And when kids get to be teenagers, I'm bored becomes a call for the parent to move into action. If parents are service providers and kids are our customers, and you are the recreation director, and your customers are bored, you figure out what to do. When I was growing up, I'm bored, my parents would have said, and your point is, you're sharing this with me because, okay? And now, kids really do expect, and parents expect of themselves, that they will be entertaining and scheduling their kids all the time. Now, I realize there are a lot of factors that have gone into this. Parents in the workforce, the environment is more dangerous and so on, but it has really gotten quite out of control. In addition to the time issue, children have become primary targets of the consumer advertising culture. Big billions of dollars put into marketing directly to kids. And if you read about this, the marketers and advertisers, I'm not against marketing and advertising, but they understand who's calling the shots now. And it is children calling the shots, and so they are directly marketing to children. And an example that's very chilling, the Wall Street Journal had this article interviewing a number of children's clothing manufacturers and marketers. You may have noticed that girls, preteen girls, six or seven to 12, have been getting more and more sexualized. Okay? As teenage sexualized clothing moves down the age group. There are one of the most popular brands for preteen girls, 7, 8-year-olds, are called Streetwalkers, the Streetwalker brand. And the marketers are realizing that the parents, mostly mothers, do not have much control anymore of what their kids, what their preteen girls are buying, so the marketers are advertising directly to children. And a Target executive said that here in the Midwest, Target does not carry Streetwalker brand, but he said they only have one line of traditional children's clothing left at Target for that are, quote, designed for 7 and 8-year-olds whose mothers are still impacting the purchase decision. One brand left where the mother is still influencing this decision. We have this reversal of the generations. I think we should now talk about authoritarian children, okay? Because here's a little story, again, in Target. A mother came in just before clothing and wanted to buy the Pokemon game, okay, very popular, and the clerk said, we're out. And the mother said, oh my goodness, would you write a letter on store stationery to my son, her 10-year-old, saying that the store is out because he won't believe me. Now in my era, if an authoritarian father had sent his kid, maybe the kid would be smart enough to ask for the letter. Now we have authoritarian children and parents running scared. Okay, so let me tell you about the grassroots movement that's starting. It's a group that came out of a town meeting in Wayzata, Minnesota, to deal with these kinds of issues, particularly the first issue about the time. We haven't taken on the consumer purchase one yet. A movement to take back our kids, and the group decided to call themselves Family Life First. It's a broad-based, parent-led movement that is not villainizing or scapegoating anybody. What we're doing is we've developed a mission statement that we want to build a community where family life is a celebrated and valued priority, not relegated to second or third or fourth place. What we're doing in the last several months is that we are doing what are called stakeholder interviews. We're using a public action model that comes from the Center for Democracy and Citizenship at the University of Minnesota. We're doing stakeholder interviews. We're interviewing parents, youth, the police chief, the coaches, we're interviewing a lot of people, and we're finding out everybody's concern. Even the coaches that some people think are not concerned are concerned. And what we are about to develop in the next couple months, and we're going to do this collaboratively, is a Family Life First seal of approval for organizations, all kinds of organizations, sporting teams, scouts, religious organizations, for community groups that have a set of explicit working policies that acknowledge, support, and respect family decisions to make family time a priority. So your kid is not benched for the year for going to the wedding. Okay? And so we're going to try to do this in a positive way with a grassroots movement to acknowledge groups who we think are doing this well. And we will get a lot of publicity for this. There is a tremendous interest in this. All over. That's what we're finding. And then the public policy aspects of this, clearly I'm not suggesting that government officials take charge of this. This would be against the democratic theory that this is based on. This is a grassroots movement that must go this way. But what can public officials think of? They can be catalytic in this. They can help something occur. So what I'm suggesting is that at the state level, that consider creating and funding a network of community circles, family coalitions, or public discussion forums of parents, grandparents, and youth to explore, to consult with experts about the declining influence of parents and families in raising their children. The way in which we are surrendering our children to the peer culture, to a life of overbusyness, and to the advertising world. I would suggest that these groups would make recommendations about what individual families can do, because ultimately individual families and parents have to make decisions. What families collectively can do, and that's what our Family Life First group is working on. What nonprofits and faith communities can do, because what I'm suggesting is that a lot of organizations are part of the problem, including the faith communities are part of the problem. And we have clergy in our Family Life First group who are doing some soul searching about the way in which churches schedule and overschedule people. Let me give you an example of this, that a church community in a rural town in Minnesota had an intergenerational group get together to plan something for the year. They got together in October, and they tried to plan their next meeting. They could not meet again until February because of everybody's schedules, particularly the youth schedules, and the church, they realized, was part of the problem. What they decided to do, and they would get our Family Life First seal of approval for this, they decided that all of their church events would be on Saturday, Sunday, or Wednesday night, period. And that means if you're on two committees that meet on Wednesday, you make a choice. But they realized that the church itself was eroding the connections within family members by having lots of very good activities that drew people away from the family. So what the nonprofits and faith communities can do, and what the local, state, and federal governments can do. The goal would be to catalyze a state and national movement of families to take on projects to strengthen families, to take back our kids from the surrendering we're doing to the peer culture, to a world of too much busyness, and to the advertising and marketing culture. And to do this in nonpartisan ways, but powerful ways. So much of our activities for families are program-oriented. They are professionally driven, program-oriented. We set the goals, we do the evaluation. What I'm suggesting, this is a model for how to think about the galvanizing of parents in groups to take on issues of common concern. I was just talking to a colleague of mine about this yesterday before I got on the plane to come here, and she said, well, is this like a support group of parents, this Family Life First group, who get together to try to counteract these forces? I said, no, this is a change the world group. This is a change the world group. And people are using the language, it starts here. This is ground zero. We do talk about ourselves, because in our check-in at the beginning of this, the question is, what's on your mind about our work together? What's on your mind? And sometimes it's about, I interviewed the football coach and I was amazed that he's really on board with this. Or it might be a story of a personal victory, of allowing this. One mother said she helped her daughter negotiate staying on the soccer team, but only going to one practice a week, not two, because she was getting burned out. And the coach said, I understand that. Okay? So sometimes people report something personal, but what we are about is not a support group, but a group to try to start a grassroots movement. And I'm suggesting there are other this is a model of grassroots activism that's nonpartisan, that's not asking the government to carry the ball, but is saying, let's have parents carry the ball to each other. Thank you.